and existentialism. And oddly enough, nothing came up. And so Jez and Robert were kind enough to make some other suggestions, which are really lovely. Also, a friend asked me on the way here if I had some existential humor. And she mentioned a bumper sticker she just saw, which said, "I'm in that awkward stage between birth and death." And I think that covers a lot. And there is one other thought, too. I will admit I had some nervousness before this talk, and a friend said, just relax, be yourself. And that always reminds me of something that Harriet Lerner wrote in one of her books about a time that a professor returned a term paper to her and said, "The writing in here is too flowery and too ornate. Just be yourself. P.S. If this is yourself, try being someone else." So with all that... Is this projecting okay without the mic? Or? Okay, is that better? Okay, thank you. So I'm going to be talking about how love and sex intersect with existential givens, death, meaninglessness, isolation, and freedom. And I sincerely hope that none of you leave here with that random sense of despair that Robert was talking about. I hope you leave with a more empowered feeling. There are, my work has been mostly based on working with couples in long-term relationships or relationships who would like to sustain sexual intimacy. There are obviously many, many angles on sex that we could talk about, but that's been the focus of my work, so I'm primarily speaking from that direction. And in that work, there are several, these themes do come up very often, and I'm just going to talk about how they manifest, particularly in discussions about sexual intimacy. As part of preparing this, I thought a lot about a sermon that Lanier gave about 30 years ago, in which he talked about how do you know what your values are? And he said, just ask yourself, how do I spend my time and my money? And that is very pertinent to this topic because... in one survey that I looked at of women in same-sex relationships, and I think these apply to people in all sorts of relationships, so, but among these women, 92% said that they agreed that sustaining sexual intimacy was very important in a committed relationship. When asked on that same survey how many actually set aside time in their schedules to make room for intimacy, 20% said they did. So I call this a high-value, low-priority problem. 92% think this is very important. 20% are actually setting aside some time for this, which is part of thinking again about how do you know what you value, how do you spend your time and your money. After all these beautiful songs about love, I hate to mess it up a little bit, but I want to give you a new scientific definition of love. And I like this because it makes it very workable to me, and it I think you can work with this. This is based on the work by Barbara Fredrickson, who is a psychology researcher at UNC Chapel Hill, has written several books, including one called Love 2.0. It's an upgrade of your definition of love. And what she says, really love is positivity resonance. That love is a temporary emotion that comes up when there are three events present, very tightly interwoven. The first one is a shared positive emotion. This is talking about all kinds of love, not necessarily romantic love. But a shared positive emotion, you and, for the sake of simplicity, I'll talk about another person, although this could be more than another person. You and another person are sharing a positive emotion. There's a mutual caring between you that you know each of you is really invested in the other's well-being so that their pleasure in this emotion or sensation amplifies your own. That's, so there's the mutual caring, the positive emotion, and the third one, which is really interesting, behavioral and biochemical synchrony. You can see how this would not fit into a song very well, but behavioral synchrony means when you're both leaning into each other. If you're dancing, as we just saw, if you're in sync with each other, that's behavioral synchrony. And then biochemical synchrony is a little more complicated, and honestly, I don't understand all the neuropsych of it, but it has to do with the vagus nerve, apparently, and the ways that we actually almost literally tune into each other and get in sync. It's a nonverbal process. And by the way, it requires your actual bodies to be in proximity. Apparently, you cannot have positivity resonance online or texting or emailing. You have to actually be in the physical presence of another person. So if you think about love instead of being a static condition, which really Fredrickson talks about more as a bond, if you think of love as a series of temporary emotion, upwelling of this emotion, then technically what you want in what we call a loving relationship is really a relationship where you have a lot of moments of positivity resonance. So, make sense? And I like that way of looking at it very much, because then you can ask yourself, how much am I doing to create more positivity resonance in my relationships? And then if you take this from love to sex and think about a fantastic sexual experience, you also have shared emotion and pleasure. You have a mutual caring for each other's experience. And you definitely have some biochemical synchrony going on, hopefully. This is for a good experience. So we might call that super positivity resonance. And using that way of thinking about it, let me talk about how this way of looking at love and sex intersects with four existential givens. We'll start with isolation, the idea that we are born alone and we die alone. And what happens in between is our life and how we try to manage existential issues like isolation. Usually, that's through the form of trying to have connections with others, right? To connect with, whether in loving relationships, friends, etc. But there are a lot of ways that this particular issue can go wrong when you try to navigate human connections. For example, one method is try to deny isolation and just say, I'm just going to merge with you. I'm going to take over your life, your personality, and then I won't be alone anymore. In fact, we'll just be we together. And by the way, I want to caution or encourage all of us to think carefully when using the word we, because I believe it's overused. Many times in couples work, I've heard one person say, well, we think this and that, and the other's kind of looking like, well, that's just... So maybe try going with you and I. Another way to try to navigate isolation that doesn't usually work out very well is the sour grapes approach, which is I don't need it anyway. I'll do my own thing. I am my own person. And to some extent, of course, we do have to be our own person, but this is missing the flowing in and out, that positivity resonance gives you a way to be in sync with another person and then be out of it. And then that way we move from some merging, it could feel like merging, to isolation or distance, and going back and forth with that. That would be the ideal, I think. There's another form of isolation that may not come to mind immediately. You probably all know people who are in long-term relationships and yet feel very isolated. And one way that that can happen, and particularly I'll just focus on the sexual arena, is when there's a secret that nobody's talking about. There can either be the obvious affairs, of course, are not good for synchrony, because someone's not, it's a secret and it's not being talked about. And there is a saying, when something important is not being talked about, nothing important can be talked about. So trying to have deep conversations when there's a massive secret between you is not going to work very well. There's a more subtle kind of isolation, I think, in sexual intimacy, and that is just that many people seem to have a very hard time talking honestly about sex with each other, about what feels good and what doesn't, etc. And very often people just don't talk about this, and really I've talked to many people who've been in relationships 7-10 years and never brought up to the partner that something about the way they made love, for instance, did not feel good, or was too aggressive or too whatever. Just never mentioned it, and not surprisingly started losing a lot of interest and looking for ways to avoid sexual intimacy because it really was not feeling good. But you would ask, why won't you talk about it? And as you can guess, there's a huge fear of hurting someone's feelings or of being too vulnerable. And so that can go unsaid. And I think that's a really big issue in how we can be in a relationship and yet isolated in that way. So again, with the isolation theme, I think the ideal would be to be able to move in and out of that kind of closeness or positivity resonance. Another existential issue is meaninglessness, and how do we create meaning in our life given that it's not just handed to us? And this is really an important one also in sexual relationships, because you have to ask, you know, what is love and sex? What does it mean to you? And does it mean the same thing to you as it does to me? Because for some people, sex can be a wonderful way to express loving feelings, super positivity resonance with all those factors there. And for others, sex may be more about self-esteem. If you want me, then I feel worthwhile. For others, it can be about just fun or casual. And it's not that there's an inherent right or wrong about any of these, but it's really important to be sure that you check what it means to me and what does that mean to you. Because when you have a mismatch, people start telling each other what it should mean to me or you. And that doesn't usually go well either. And there's a really issue under meaning that comes up a great deal. And this is, what does spontaneous sexual desire mean to you? Because there is this myth that's pretty tightly held that sex should happen spontaneously. And that if it doesn't, that if it happens because you planned it, like you put it on the schedule Saturday morning, then it doesn't really count because it's not spontaneous. If you did it intentionally, putting all your energy and so forth and really planning for this, that does not count as much as if it just happened spontaneously, like some random urge just came over you and bam, there you are. And that supposedly means that it's really real. That does not mean that to me, and I trust not to you, but what folks say about planning or setting aside time, which is really the key, in that survey that looked at how much do you value sex, 92% yes, how much do you set aside time for it, 20%, those were also the 20% who were actually sexually active. And in talking with some of these folks, talked to people who were and were not, and people who were not sexually active said, no, I wouldn't dream of scheduling it. That's too contrived. It's awkward. It needs to be spontaneous. These were the folks who were not having sex, okay? So that's not a good plan for sustaining sexual intimacy. And being intentional about it is your way of saying, this is important, it means a lot, let's plan this together and let's make it a priority. I will tell you the Costco story. This was in a workshop for couples, women couples, and we were talking about if you did want to have sexual intimacy in your relationship, when could you make time for it? Because everybody's busy, right? We have two careers, households, families, responsibilities, tennis lessons, golf lessons, whatever. All these, and then when is there, when would be a good time for the two of us to really have time together? And one person said, well, you know, Saturday morning would be perfect for us because we're relaxed, it's the beginning of the weekend, We don't have any lessons planned or anything like that. We have some free time Saturday morning, so that would be great. And then her partner said, yeah, but that's when I like to go to Costco. She said, the lines aren't as long. You can get all the paper towels and toilet paper you need for the week. And all these things are fresher. Now, this person did have the grace to laugh when someone else said in the group said, you know, Costco's open on Saturday afternoon also. And in fact, it's open every day of the week. So she did laugh about that and decided to go ahead with the Saturday morning plan. Oh, one other thing about spontaneity. I was working with this man one time whose wife was very upset with him because he never wanted to have sex. And they had small children, which does make it realistically more difficult to find time. But he realized that he really needed to do something or he was in trouble. And then he said, well, his wife's birthday was coming up in about 3 weeks, and he wanted to plan a weekend away. So he went online and reserved a cabin in the mountains. He checked out nearby towns and found a really good restaurant, made reservations. He also looked into hiking trails that were around there and decided where they could go. And most importantly, he got his parents to agree to take the children for the weekend. So they headed off to the mountains, and then after this experience, he came back and talked to me about it, which, you know, you always feel a little nervous when someone plans that much. What's actually going to happen. He was very happy. He said they had a wonderful time. We went on a long hike. We sat on the deck and watched the sunset. We talked. We really connected emotionally because we talked about some things that we've been troubling for each of us, and we didn't know that the other was struggling, and we talked. And then we just felt so good, and we made love, and it was wonderful. It was so spontaneous. I'm not making this up. That was really the words that came. So, I trust you get the idea that I don't think spontaneity is a good plan to work for a sustaining relationship. And then there's the existential given of freedom, which also can cause some problems, right? Because freedom does have this little thing called responsibility that goes with it. You're free to say yes or no to sex. I mean, ideally, you're free. I realize there are many, many people who actually are not free, so I'm not overlooking that. But in a situation, most of the people I've worked with are in a situation where they are free to say yes or no to sex. And sometimes can complain to the other partner that you're pressuring me. I need to be free to do this when I'm ready. And the problem with freedom is, you know, that responsibility thing. These choices do have consequences, right? They have implications. Because if you think of sex as a team sport, meaning it really does take two people to make it work, and ideally in a team sport you have the same goal, right? You're both trying to move the ball down the field or whatever sport it is. And what does not work well in a team sport is for one person to just kind of walk off the field and say, I don't really feel like playing today. Of course, there are circumstances when that can come up. But when you choose to be with someone and you start a relationship with some assumption that this is going to be a sexual relationship, to kind of independently change your mind about that and not discuss it with your partner, I think is not really fair. So, yes, you, and this is, it's tricky. Of course, pressuring someone does not feel good, and it doesn't really work very well. The problem some couples have is they think, well, I'll just, the person who's, you know, higher desire, I'm going to stop mentioning it and pressuring it, and you just come to me when you're ready, which sounds good in theory, right? If I'm not being pressured, of course I'll come forward. In reality, it hardly ever happens. What often happens is that sex just comes to a complete stop. So I think that approach of just leaving it alone and waiting for the other person not to feel pressured doesn't work out very well. And this, again, is, I think, where you need to look at this. Is this a team sport? Are we both participating here? And what can we both do to make this viable for both of us? And then finally, the big existential given is death. The fact that there, time is limited and it does run out. And I also would like to say death of our physical bodies. We can have some disagreement about what happens to the soul or where the soul or spirit is before or after physical life, but there's not much disagreement about the fact that our bodies die at some point. And so between birth and death, that awkward stage, is your window of opportunity. This is your opportunity for living a physically embodied life. So knowing our time is limited, what do we want to do with it? There are some interesting studies of people who have had near-death experiences in which they're perhaps pronounced dead and then come back to life and so forth. And they often talk about a white light and a very peaceful feeling and then being drawn to come back. And from these studies, there seem to be three themes that come up that people will report they really changed in these three ways. One was that people come back from near-death experiences because of the people in their life that they love. There, as you've heard, I'm sure, no one on their deathbed says, I wish I had spent more time at the office. They will say, I wish I'd spent more time with my loved ones. So that is probably the biggest theme from those experiences. Another is the importance of living in the present, because we really today really is all we have for sure. We don't know for sure about tomorrow. But we are here today, and so how can we be as physically here today as possible, which usually in Gestalt exercises involves tuning into your awareness of the senses. For example, what are you seeing and smelling and tasting and hearing and feeling tactily, like you're sitting in your chairs and your feet are on the floor, that your back is being supported. This is a way to center yourself in the present, in your physical body. And then the third theme that comes back from these near-death experiences is a greater sense of perspective. What's really important, which ties right into the focus on what are your priorities? Sometimes we ask, 5 years from now, will it really matter that you didn't get your house cleaned up before the neighbors dropped in? Or will it really matter that I didn't write that memo as well as I should have? Or a million other things that I'm sure we can all think of, things that we get a little bit obsessive or preoccupied with that really are not that big a deal when you look in the big picture. And so that is another gift that can come from looking at near-death experiences and what that brings to our life. And so, in conclusion, I would invite you to think about how can you use this existential framework to enrich your love life and your sex life if you want to? And how can you use the concept of positivity resonance to focus on, instead of a concept of love, how can I create more moments of positivity resonance in my life and help my partner in her life, in his life? And back to Lanier's point about how do you know your values? What do you spend your time and your money on? So you can ask yourself in terms of love, sex, positivity, resonance, is this a high value for you? And can you make it a high priority? And thank you very much.